Those of you who have looked up Matisse on the web will be surprised to see that I've changed my appearance. My name's Nick Rawlins, and I'm Pro Vice Chancellor for Development, and I am delighted to welcome you all to the second André Hoffmann Lecture, the inaugural lecture, which was held just over a year ago in February 2013. Was a wonderful occasion. The lecturer was Jim Leap, the Director General of the Worldwide Fund for Nature. But this evening's lecture is going to be a no less extraordinary event. Our lecturer this evening is Matthijs Wackernagel, the President of the Global Footprint Network, who will ask the question, is sustainability too expensive? And I rather suspect will answer it in no uncertain terms as well. You'll have spotted that there's a theme here. It's no coincidence that both lectures have been concerned with the environment and our place in it, coupled with our responsibilities to it. Now, André himself will tell you a bit more about Matthijs in a moment, but before he does that, I'm allowing myself the pleasure of telling you something about André and a bit more about the theme, perhaps. So I've no doubt, in fact, I know that some of you here already know André, and that he'll be for you, as he is for me, one of that select group of people that it's always a pleasure to see, a friend of warmth, interest, and distinction. But he's also someone whose kindness and support go far beyond individual friendships. André's philanthropy takes many forms. To give you a little flavour, he's helped to underpin the conservation of musical manuscripts. He supports the opera in Lausanne. He's concerned with the exceptionally important and very long-term projects that concern empowerment of women and girls in India and Africa. But I think it's clear, and of course it's always dangerous to make comments like this when the person after you is the person you're talking about, so be nice, André, don't show me up. I think it's clear that his heart lies above all in conservation and nature. And the Hoffmann Foundation, which he set up in 2000 with his wife, Rosalie, focused specifically on the goals of sustainable development, improving the quality of international governance, and supporting projects in the fields of education and culture. All three of those goals are represented here today. In the audience are some current students from the 17 scholars who have been or are supported by the Weidenfeld Hoffmann Scholarships. André's been supporting the Weidenfeld Scholarship Programme, which was the brainchild of Lord Weidenfeld and Sir Ronnie Grierson, who isn't here but has a seat reserved for him, since 2009. Their current students' interests include developmental economists, geographers, conservationists, and civil society activists. Catch them after the lecture and find out more about what they do. And what have their predecessors done? Well, some are out in the world's trouble spots. I see Somalia, Afghanistan, Bosnia, not quite as bad as it was, but still interesting. Others in environmental protection and biodiversity, still others are working with the IMF. Conservation, sustainability, international governance indeed, and all linked by an education made possible by scholarships. That's something very big to celebrate, and that's what we're doing today. So it's my great personal pleasure to introduce André Hoffmann himself, who'll tell you something about today's lecturer. But before I do so, may I also ask you all to thank André for his sponsorship of the lecture, as well as for his vision in supporting the Weidenfeld Hoffmann Scholarships, for his support for many different aspects of our university more widely, and beyond that, for what he's doing across significant swathes of the globe. André Hoffmann.
Well, it's of course very embarrassing, to, as you say, to hear all these things being said about me. Maybe just two words. I think that it's a particular pleasure for me to be able to have Matthijs Wackernagel doing this lecture tonight, because what he does is not the traditional conservation of nature as we define it normally. I believe that the tradition of conservation, which is based on protecting species, biodiversity, and protecting areas, is a very important activity, and we need to go on doing as much as possible of that, but it clearly is not enough. We need to look at the problem in a more holistic manner, and for that we need a comprehensible metric. And I think one of the reasons why Mathis is very appropriate for this lecture today is because he has discovered, developed, propagated this notion of ecological footprint. And he will, of course, refer to this much better than I can. But perhaps I can just go quickly through his biography to explain to you why I think his presence here tonight is, in fact, a very great opportunity for us. He's a PhD. He's the co-creator of the Ecological Footprint. And the Ecological Footprint is a resource accounting approach he developed during his PhD with Bill Rees. Now he's the president of Global Footprint Network, which is an international sustainability think tank. Notice the word think tank, which is usually used for other type of international engagements, but which I think are very appropriate here. I don't want to go into the details of what the footprint does, because I expect that's going to be part of your speech, Mathis. Just want to give a couple of your awards. You are the 2002 Blue Planet Award. You are a visiting professor at Cornell University. You received the 2012 Binding Prize for Nature Conservation, the 2012 Kenneth Boulding Memorial Award, and, a distinction you share with my father, you also had the Zayed International Prize for the Environment. And I'm very grateful that you found the time to come here and to speak, and I don't think I have much more to say than that. Thank you very much for coming, Mathis, and thank you all of you too for listening.
Good afternoon, and thank you, André. It's a great pleasure to see you all here on a sunny day, that you would choose us. That's particularly exciting. I had the great opportunity to be invited to a class of 11-year-olds to talk about our work. And that's always very pleasing, because young people, we talked about that just before, have much more profound questions. So you learn more from them than you can ever give them. And so they didn't know about the footprint much. I asked them, how would you measure nature? A girl put up her hand and she said, square miles. I said, wow, it took us a few years to think that through. And then I asked, so why would you like to know, why would you need to know how much nature we have compared to how much we use? Immediately, the same girl put up her hand and said, if we use more than what we have, the only thing left to eat is imaginary cookies. After that, I was kind of done with my lecture, I guess. I could go home. And I wondered, and have wondered since, how is it that young people can see what's so obvious? And as a society, we totally forget. And it seems so alien. And that's why I wonder a little bit whether I come here just with a few platitudes. Some things that seem so obvious to me, but perhaps culturally we cannot capture. I often feel like traveling the world, telling about the wonderful idea that opening your window and throwing out money is not in your personal interest. And people say, oh, how interesting, never thought of that. So that's a bit the theme of the lecture. But before that, I mean, we learn from our children, but we also learn from our ancestors and elders. And I would like, just because of the Hoffman lecture, to start there. One inspiration is your father, Luke Hoffman, 91 years old. And inspiring that he, I think, without too much encouragement from his family, just particularly being caught in Switzerland during World War II, looked at the migration birds as his inspiration. They could still travel. And learn from them to recognize that ecosystems don't exist on their own. That actually, without having landing spots around the world, migration birds cannot exist. And because of that, driving conservation, not just species by species, but recognizing the significance of ecosystems and how they are connected in very practical ways, and how important it is to have networks and to work together, and how important it is to stand back, by him being so humble, having other people stand in the light and build an organization that probably now is the most influential conservation organization. Without him, it wouldn't exist. Reframing stories, rather than calling areas swamps that you need to avoid, calling them wetlands, and developing international agreements, showing them as something positive rather than a pest to avoid. And with that, then also, the next generation, Andre, another giant, not just his father, and bringing in also the business perspective. He was so generous, and just to disclose that also, conflict of interest, I don't know that. Andre was generous enough to be on our board as a still small and wobbly organization and enduring administrative board meetings and helping us really strengthen our effect in the world. And so I'm really glad to be here with you. And I'm here with you because we need a lot of help. We need help to understand how to push this idea further. The more I learn about these issues, the less I understand them. And that's fascinating. That keeps me up every day. And actually, tomorrow, I will go to London on a 10:30 train, but I reserved the time for breakfast. Anybody interested in having breakfast with me tomorrow to think further what we could do, please let me know. And I'm hopeful that you'll join me tomorrow. So, is sustainability too expensive? And again, also as a disclosure, did it work before? Is there another way to move the slides? Oh. Wonderful, yeah. Good old keyboard. Good. To disclose, I was trained initially as an engineer, and the French call it déformation professionnelle. You know, there's some pieces of the brain that just don't get developed and some concepts that don't make sense anymore if you're on a certain track. And for engineers, there's some concepts like hope and fear that don't exist. You know, it's just about, does it work or does it not work? When you're asked to calculate whether a bridge is strong enough, and you say, actually, I did make the calculation, it does take 3 beams more to really be safe, nobody comes to tell you, why are you not more optimistic? You know, cheer up. And I think that's also how I approach the sustainability conundrum. It's not a religion. It's ultimately a calculation. Does it work out or does it not work out? What does it take to work out? And to explore that first, I'd like to make the entrance through a more popular theme, climate change, for a number of reasons, as we will explore, and then broaden the perspective to its a more whole world. But starting with the question, who do you think has the highest CO2 emission per capita on this list? And what do you think? France? Mm-hmm. Actually, they are in the order of emissions. Switzerland now, where I'm from, and Andre is from, we have less CO2 emission than China per capita. And when you tell that story in Switzerland, people say, okay, we're only 8 million people, the Chinese are 1 billion, what should we do? You know? It's not worth putting effort into it because we're so small. And I would say it's exactly the opposite. China doubled its energy consumption in just 10 years. Switzerland uses 4 times more resources than its ecosystems can renew. The world is changing extremely rapidly, even though in Switzerland we don't perceive it because the cities look pretty much the same as they did 100 years ago. So we feel, oh, it's the same thing. But in a rapidly changing world, if Switzerland is not ready for that world, who is going to get squashed against the wall? So it's actually the opposite. If nobody does anything, it's even more imperative for Switzerland to act swiftly and decisively just to save its own skin. I think that's the contradiction that is not so much understood, particularly through the climate debate. We emphasize the tragedy of the commons. I hear Oxford is spending $160 million to floodproof Oxford because of climate change pressures. You know, we could put $160 million into making Oxford more energy efficient. I see a lot of single pane glass here still. But then would that reduce flooding in Oxford? No. So most people believe, and that's how we go 19 times to the same convention called climate change convention, not learning anything about kind of the difficulty of arranging things, believing, oh, actually, it's a tragedy of the commons. We shouldn't offer too much if the others don't offer anything. If we stayed home, rather than going to the conference saying, what actually would be in our interest if the world is going crazy? If everybody does it, it doesn't mean it's normal. It just means it accelerates the compound risk. We would have far more aggressive sustainability strategies. And that's the theme I would like to talk about. But let me start from the fossil fuel perspective first. A graph that I looked at a month ago or so and was quite taken, that I never really thought about it that way, and put it into three phases. Oil, because oil is a very particular juice. It makes things possible that are much more difficult with other energy sources, like flying, using energy in remote places because you can store it easily, agriculture, much easier with access to oil. And what we see is since 1900, where fossil fuel, where oil was negligible as a metabolism for humanity, it has grown, the blue line, nearly mathematically exponentially. Now, perhaps the data is not that clean, or perhaps it's simplified, but what struck me when I saw the graph is that you don't even see World War II. It doesn't even show as a wiggle. Because rather than putting gas in cars, we put gas into tanks. You know, so just it's a self-accelerating machinery that gets more hungry and gets better at finding more fossil fuel, accelerating itself, being bigger next year to eat more fossil fuel. And that produces an exponential curve, a very clean exponential curve. The red and the green curve show who is providing, extracting this oil. The red curve being non-OPEC countries. OPEC didn't exist by then, but you can still divide them. And then with the end of World War II, or end of colonialism to some extent, more countries exploring their own oil sources, reaching a market share of half by 1972. What do you do if you have half the market share? You start to be able to corner the market. That's what happened. It is called the oil crisis. I mean, it has a political context as well, but you only can manipulate if you have certain muscles in the market. And the situation started to become much more volatile. Second phase of the oil age, they were, like people say, people cannot contain themselves, but actually very strongly contained themselves in kind of extraction. Some people call it production. It's actually extraction. No oil is being produced. Then the others try to compensate and expand even more rapidly. It's called North Sea oil. And prices started to become wobbly. They took a hit. And things have been more, not exponential, but kind of steady, we think. And now we're entering into the third age with new tendencies, that the easy oil is starting to get more difficult to get. So that's kind of the easy oil assumptions. We know OPEC countries will have a longer breath. Already today, for the first time, non-OECD countries use more oil than OECD countries. So you're on a total shift. Yet we still hope that we can continue the past. It's our right to oil is unbroken. So how do we deal with this? Or why are you not dealing with this? Perhaps a bigger question. And I looked at it just recently. I picked up Financial Times. I hope nobody here is kind of too much linked to the Financial Times. I was just stunned. They looked at Scotland, at its economic performance. Would it do okay on its own or not? And if you look at its headline, well, in summary, it said, the country has the ingredients to be a viable nation state, but demographic problems loom. Which I didn't fully understand because the population apparently only grows 4% as compared to 20% in the UK. Is that the biggest problems that they face? They also showed that the income in Scotland, if 100 is the UK, in Scotland is 110, London is 170 without oil. 110 in Scotland, but if you take out the oil sector, it's only 90. They may forget that also the kindergarten teachers get paid better if there's a very wealthy oil sector. So it's kind of, there's kind of a compounding effect. And then they show on the bottom of the page, that's kind of nice, that they show the curve of how much oil the North Sea has been able to generate for us. I was in Aberdeen in 1973 with my family as a small boy, and even I noticed that it's quite a poor town. You know. And then suddenly you had this kind of huge income, and then this very, very rapid decline. The article doesn't even mention it much. Because there's some predictions how much they will be able to produce or not. Now, what do I know about the future of Scotland? On the one hand, we print it, but we don't even discuss it. We say the looming problem is demographics. I wonder. And then there are other questions that I would like to know. Maybe there's a substitute. Maybe they have a lot of hydropower. Maybe they have a lot of biological sources, trees. I don't know. Nothing is analyzed here. So it shows kind of this blindness to something that seems so obvious to the child, the imaginary cookie, while even in the Financial Times, when he tried to give me an analysis, is Scotland strong? Can it live well? Does it have the resource base to sustain itself in a resource-constrained world? We have some funny glimpses, and we don't even discuss them. So it's kind of just the funny situation we are in. So when we talk about resources, if we say we depend on physical reality, what do we mean? And many people, particularly those more addicted to iPhones, they worry a lot about rare earth. Because we hear that even for windmills, apparently, we need rare earth. Are they limited? Of course they're limited, but perhaps not meaningfully limited, because with more energy, we can dig deeper holes and find more, and that's what we have seen. So perhaps the effort gets bigger. So does that mean, ultimately, what is really limited is the energy to dig holes? And commercial energy now is constrained mostly by fossil fuel. That's our largest source of commercial energy today. Is it limited? And I would say you can look at it from very different angles. If we listen to some climate scientists that think 350 ppm is already an upper limit, and we have passed that because we had 400, or perhaps 450 may be the limit, I don't know. But then even including non-CO2 greenhouse gases, we are closer to 450 already. That would mean we should stop using fossil fuel yesterday. Or we could say, okay, we can have a little bit more, let's go to 550. But even that would mean very rapid phasing out of fossil fuels. I haven't seen much evidence of that. Or we could say, as the Institute of Mechanical Engineers says in the UK, and I think quite wisely they say, we have gone to buffets and people just empty them. That's what human nature is. And we will empty the buffet, and that will lead to a 1700 ppm world. Sorry about that. Deal with it. You know. So whatever path we take, what we start to recognize, the limiting factor is not fossil fuel itself. We may already have too much fossil fuel found on the ground, as the carbon tracker points out. So that means, again, it's the absorptive capacity of the planet that is limiting. Or we want to phase out more quickly even out of fossil fuel. That means we need other capacities to substitute for the fossil fuel that we don't have. Or we just use everything up, and that means we transform the world radically, won't have fossil fuel, and we'll have a much weaker planet to sustain life and provide us with the metabolism we are so used to. So what that means is the true limitation, or the overarching limitation, is the Earth's ability to renew. Simply said, it's the farm. How big is the farm? That's what we depend on. The Earth as our largest soda collector, as our largest farm. And that becomes a useful lens to look at the future, because it helps us understand in a more simple way how the world works, the competition between various uses, But also, I think it will help to build a self-interest story more easily. The idea is very simple. We are in competition for space. If I grow tomatoes here, we couldn't have this center here, you know? So either the center or tomatoes. The fish I eat, the seal cannot eat. So there's competition for space for various services. We could sequester far more CO2 on our surfaces, but then again, we would have less tomatoes. Tomatoes pay better than CO2 sequestration, so we need the one or the other, you know? So it's kind of this competition over space. So we can simply add things up, like a farmer. How much farm does it take to support everything that I consume? The coffee that I drink, the orange juice, the cereals, the cotton, the wool, everything. And it's not everything, you know, it's not everything about the world, but you get a first sense of scale. And we can measure it in a commensurable unit that allows accounting. For example, economics often uses dollars. Earlier pounds when it was still more of an empire, but now it's more dollars that are used as a common currency to compare economies across the world. We use what we call global hectares. We just look at which hectares are ecologically productive on the world, and then we scale them proportional to their productivity. So a more productive hectare is worth more, a less productive one less. That's what farmers do as well. Farmers, they call it, for example, in Texas, cow, calf, acres. You know, it's not just how big the farm is, but how productive is the farm to generate to support cattle. And so it helps us then, such a tool, to think about what success may mean. And to understand what success means, it's always useful to start with, what's the question? That's what Einstein said, you know, if he had a problem to solve and he only has 1 hour, and his life depended on the answer, the first 55 minutes he would spend on finding out what's the question. And I think that's perhaps what comes with engineering thinking too. If you think about planes, for example, when you design a plane, the question is, well, the issue is, what are the questions? What are the key things a pilot needs to know in order to safely navigate? And it's different for each stage of the flight. If you take off, you know, you need to understand how fast you are to be able to lift. If you are over a mountain, you need to understand how high you are from the mountain, not to crash into the mountain. Once you fly in the plane for a few hours, it may be useful to check how much fuel is left. Same thing for the UK. What are the key questions? I think it would be useful for David Cameron to understand, how much UK do you have? How much UK do you use? How is that changing? How is it changing in your trade partners? Are you becoming more and more dependent on countries that may themselves run larger and larger biocapacity deficits? Now people say, yeah, but we can substitute things. Of course we can substitute. We're just bookkeepers. We look at everything combined. It's a combination of five factors. How many people consume how much? How efficient is it being produced? How much area do we have to generate? And how productive are these areas? So these are the five mathematical factors. It's just a description of what is. Can we decouple or not? Maybe technology can. But we can just track it over time. So planes are very complex, and still they simplify information to this very simple display. But sometimes the pilots, they just know, now I have to look at this, now I have to look at that. Our contribution for policy is to say there's one particular dial. It's not worth putting a chewing gum on top, you know. Not to see it is not helpful. Planes with chewing gums on fuel gauges are not allowed to fly. But we let nations fly without fuel gauges. We don't even worry. We have nations put more energy into buying chewing gum to put on these dials rather than to implement them. Now, from a platitude perspective, you can say fuel gauges do matter today. We are in a new world. We have lived in situations where fuel became exponentially more available, as I showed, pre-1972. We are now in a new world. And we can demonstrate that in quantitative terms. When I was born 50 years ago, most countries, if you look at them like farms, and I mean by farms, not just the farmland, it's all the wetland, the forest areas, the grazing areas, the productive areas that we paved over as we did in Oxford. If you add them all up as the big farm and say, how much does it take to maintain the metabolism on which we depend? Then you can look at the ratio, metabolism, demand versus availability. And you can start to distinguish which farms are true farms. A true farm is a farm that produces significantly more than what the farm family consumes themselves. Red farms in the United States we call hobby farms. I don't know if that's the same in the UK. Now, over the last 50 years in my lifetime, things have shifted quite dramatically. We have moved to a world of hobby farms. And the question becomes, if you are a hobby farm, does that matter? If Switzerland used four times more 50 years ago, is that different from using four times more today? That's an interesting question, because in Switzerland, for example, we have a new initiative, we have popular initiatives that says we should have a green economy. I don't know if they meant of that. We should have a green economy. So they said, let's, by 2050, so far away, let's live in a way so it becomes replicable worldwide. So if that metabolism, like the level of metabolism that everybody could have worldwide, which is still slightly colonial because Switzerland has less biocapacity than the world per capita. And the interesting reaction of the government was, it hasn't been voted on by the people yet, but their counter-reaction was a great idea to have a green economy. But just getting to a one-planet economy by 2050, that's just too difficult and too risky. And that's surprising to me, because it seems to me that not getting there is much riskier. But that's not ingrained in their thinking. It was very obvious to the 11-year-old, not at all obvious to the governing council of Switzerland, and most people probably in Switzerland. That's why we run a little initiative every year we call Earth Overshoot Day. It's a bit of a gimmick, but it's a way to make the information accessible. And we had last year 220 million people watching this news on internet alone, plus media stories. And we changed the story a little bit. Before, we said, how many planets would it take if everybody lives like a Swiss? Three. Oh, well, that's nice. How interesting. I like to live like a Swiss. We turned the story around to now say, how many Italys does it take to support Italy? How many UKs does it take to support the UK? And suddenly people feel, actually, it's about me. It's not about a world or something in the abstract. It's about, how would I be able to operate in a world that becomes more hungry for resources? And we continue to have phone calls from journalists. Before, it was just kind of an oddity, sort of a strange, interesting story that you could read in news, but not of clear meaning. Let me give you another example. Ecuador, one of the 10 or so countries, I think now about 14, that have looked at the footprint in more details. That shows the graph, the red line shows how much per person is being used in Ecuador. So they're starting to use a little bit more. And how much Ecuador is there by person? This influenced by how big Ecuador is, obviously. How productive Ecuador is. So with agricultural shifts, you can make your country more productive and biocapacity changes. And how many people share Ecuador. So it's many drivers that overall led to far less Ecuador per person. So probably the dominant driver for Ecuador was demographics, population increasing. So they had five times more Ecuador 50 years ago. Now they are starting to enter a biocapacity deficit. When they saw it for the first time, some, perhaps I should say economists, they were economists, they said, hey, you must be against the right to develop. They call it el derecho al desarrollo. And we said, absolutely not. We build on everybody should be able to have a great life. That's the basic notion. What we see here is not something against el derecho al desarrollo. This is el derecho al colapso. Doesn't help you. And it wasn't just only us. I mean, there was some sympathy also in the administration, and they now, in their national development plan, say we need to move out of our biocapacity deficit. Have they moved fast enough? No. But it's interesting that they take up this notion without us bringing money, without us pushing them, without them having international pressure or even internal pressure. And they published that 2 weeks before Copenhagen, not even making the connection, according to Copenhagen, you know, the next Kyoto. They are an Annex II country, saying they shouldn't even think about their own CO2 emissions. So our international negotiation tells a country not to think about their self-interest. In some ways, it's been a strange thing because we are caught in this belief that we are trapped in a tragedy of the commons. While when you think like farmers, and that's perhaps our Swiss roots, think like farmers, you start to see, actually, it's going to hit me. I have to prepare my farm. So how does the UK look like? And we're just about to bring out the new numbers to 2010, and the UK had a particularly significant contraction. What we see is, and that's really the tragedy, overshoot, which is the theme here, which is a word that I don't know how many would associate in English language with using more than what ecosystems can regenerate, doesn't even have translations to other languages. We don't have a word in German, we don't have a word in French, there's no word in Spanish for the key disease that is kind of we are facing. And overshoot will end. That's not a question. The question is how. Are we doing it through disaster and through design? And the sad news so far is that most contractions have been imposed by tragedy. And we do everything we can to reverse it. And we are building back. I just learned today, I don't know if Catherine is here from Oxfam, she told me this. Building back better is the idea, you know, after a tsunami, you kind of build it better, but we build back worse. We will build back worse. We kind of make the holes deeper through stimulus money that is used to kind of, okay, 20% green stimulus. But does that mean 80% we commit to bigger traps? I mean, that's kind of the strange contradiction we're in. Let me bring it down to the essence. Maybe a little bit puzzling or complicated, but I think that's really, if there's one take-home lesson, so one simple concept I would like to make, which is don't think about absolute income, think about relative income. And it seems to be such a small distinction, but it will put everything upside down. And I will perhaps show, just emphasize that again here. Let's start with absolute income. That's our obsession. You know? How much money do we have? Because we can resolve everything with money. More health, more food, more housing, whatever it is. And so I do understand it's not just a conspiracy. Right? So many people look with great care at GDP numbers. So that's an outcome. Are we able to generate income? But the question is also, do we have the fuel to maintain the machine? And so the way we measure it is, are we truly on a farm that has the capacity to generate this metabolism, or are we running deficits? And if we look at the trends over the last 25 years, we see the following movement. And just to give you a sense of how much movement that is, this bar shows how much capacity, biological capacity, we have on the planet per person. That's the budget in the world at current population level, about 1.8 hectares. That's all there is per person. And we see movements of that size of many countries over the last 25 years. Yes, higher incomes typically, at the same time using significantly more resources, moving more into a deficit situation. Now, there are different interpretations. The right to develop people, they say clearly, scientific proof, the more you use up your resources, the higher your income. Let's give money to WWF on the weekends, cry a little bit, but Monday to Friday, we continue to accelerate the machinery, and we'll all be there, you know. Switzerland, you did it first, now it's our turn, type, you know. Now, the point is the following. There's also a totally different interpretation. There have been economies that have accelerated themselves. Prices have not even increased. And then there was exhaustion. Fisheries. Or for example, the buffaloes, the bisons in the United States, there were about 40 million of them. Then trains came and guns, and they were easy to harvest. Price for buffalo meat and furs apparently barely increased, and suddenly they were gone. The economy is over. Yeah. Same thing with passenger pigeons, also very cheap meat, got harvested very quickly, gone. Price didn't go up. Didn't tell us, oh, please stop. No. So could that be a possibility as well? And I think here's the key point. Switzerland always assumes there will be a benevolent world in the future. And so I will just talk about the most benevolent situation, because there can be uglier ways of getting resources. You know? Don't need to talk about it. Like World War II, think about that, and just resource war. But if you just assume WTO world, everybody has equal access, there's a great market, suddenly the market transforms. Here what we see, the market is a demand-limited market. Not enough iPhones being demanded. If there were double as many people wanting iPhones, Apple would readily produce twice as many iPhones. That's kind of a demand-limited world. When we move more into a supply-limited world, where we have like one big table with a heap of potatoes, like there are 500 potatoes here, you know, we compete for these potatoes, it becomes an auction situation. Every year, let's assume that these potatoes, I'm able to get a piece of those potatoes. Next year, I will earn twice as much. But everybody else will earn four times as much. Even though I have twice as much, it will be more difficult for me to get the share of potatoes. Get that? Yeah. So suddenly, what changes is not absolute income, but relative income. What does that mean? I have my income, and I compete with the rest of the world. It's a big cake of the world. What's the total income in the world? That's in competition with me to get the potatoes. Does that make sense? How has the relative income shifted over time? Now I'll show you that, and that's the same numbers. You can get that from the World Bank. It's not our invention. You can just track that. You see these trends. Now the trends overall, I may show them too smooth because currency convertibility, like things move a little bit wild, but they're overarching trends because if one currency goes up, the other one goes down, so in relative terms, it all balances out. But overall, we see these kind of trends. Like Switzerland, we have lost about 30% of relative income share per Swiss on average against the world. That makes sense? So our share is smaller now. The pie is bigger. So the piece is bigger still, but the share is smaller. Hmm? And now Switzerland may say, yeah, I can see there's kind of a problem, you know? We want more from the world, but our relative standing compared to the others sitting around the potato table is getting weaker. But potatoes are so cheap overall still. It's a small percentage of our GDP. We shouldn't worry about that. Yeah. So we see it's kind of a systemic challenge for us, but it's not killing us yet, you know. It may be a tumor, but it's not a cancer, you know, type interpretation. And that's really the question of saying, is that really true? If we stay on this track, it's what I would call as a strategy, and we never say it, but it's what we play. It's called losing last. Who is going down first? It's not us. Haiti goes first, and then goes up, you know. And then Switzerland is a bit later. So we're fine. But it's still losing. You're losing last. And I think that's kind of the dynamic we're caught in. And I think we need to pay much more attention to relative income. And if you start to take that seriously, what are the implications? The implication is not everybody can beat the average. It's not a winnable game overall. So there, we just were thinking, we're just doing a study for Switzerland. What are the strategies? What can you do? And you may have better ideas than me, but we came up with three strategies. One is to remove yourself to some extent from the global auction by not being on that side so much, so kind of being able to move on the other side. We think that's actually in the self-interest. Another one is hyper-growth, to outcompete everybody forever. It's like betting that you will win the World Soccer Championship forever, all the time. And another one may be to say, Switzerland, we have been able to generate so much income because also a bit of the Swiss brand. I mean, brand is not just kind of the Swiss flag, but it's kind of all that comes with it, but it's a certain advantage that we have been able to generate. That's like having oil. The UAE puts oil income into a special account, you know, to say that's for later when we don't have the easy oil. So perhaps Switzerland too should have a sovereign fund, a brand fund, to say, let's have some money aside that if once actually this becomes, this grows from a tumor into a cancer, then we can restructure if we don't want to restructure ourselves now. Yeah. So that's kind of, I don't know, I don't see other ways, but maybe have some other ideas. But it's pretty systematic. We're just writing a little study about for the Swiss government about competitiveness, because those core advisors to national governments worry a lot. They sleep very poorly and they think about risks, but they don't see the resource risk as one of them, which is surprising to us. And that's what we want to try to bring out in that study. So this is just kind of more countries. You see Australia, like 2 hectares is how much we have per person. Australia has moved that much in just 25 years. And not even increase their relative standing. Amazing. And now they cancel their climate policies. Interesting. Anyhow, let me summarize and synthesize to say, what does that mean for decisions? Because it's very practical, ultimately. It's about a bet. Maybe a brilliant student from Oxford will find the ultimate trick that all these constraints evaporate and suddenly technology takes care of everything. Maybe. I don't know. There's a chance. There's a little chance that this student hasn't arrived yet. I don't know. You know. And if not, how would you need to organize your investment portfolio? How do you need to hedge? What kind of assets will survive this kind of a world? Because I believe we know more about the future than sometimes we want to know. I'm not sure what the interest is not wanting to know, because you can actually hedge your bets better. Why bet your entire farm on this imaginary Oxford student? So if we look at this long-term trend, slightly old trend, but over my lifetime, this has been the trend of humanity from using a bit more than half of the planet to now about 1.5 planets, roughly, worth of resources. It's possible to use more than what there is, even though technology changes and everything changes, but it's possible because you can cut trees more quickly than they regrow. For example, you can pump CO2 more quickly in the atmosphere and it's being absorbed. So it's totally possible, like with money, to spend more than what is being regenerated. Now, how will it continue? And we don't know, but what we did do is we translated United Nations hopes into numbers. They've had these projections. How many people will there be? Oh, they should be fed better. They need some energy, etc. Then you add it all up, then it looks like this. That's kind of the conventional moderate dream of that's how things will get better in the world, with no relationship to physical reality. And whether that will happen or not, I doubt. I think as likely could be that we have increased volatility because it gets more difficult to access these resources. Because this strain somehow, it's a cumulative strain. It's not just a difference. It's the accumulation of the debt, the stock that you start to deplete, and the sinks that you start to fill. So the way this links to investments is the following. Most people misconceive investments as paper. Do you think it's paper being shuffled on Wall Street? But actually, paper represents physical reality, hopefully. Some don't, but some do. So you want to know, what's behind this investment? What's the physical reality? Because the physical realities, they have a very long lifespan. It's not just people that live long, hopefully. It's also physical infrastructure. Many patterns in European cities were laid by Romans 2,000 years later. They're still there. I don't know, need to tell people in Oxford how long houses can last. And if we have single pane 100 years ago and we think it's so beautiful, we cannot change that. We think it's more important to have single pane until we feel the pain. But anyhow, so there are long patterns that tell us, will these assets become liabilities or will they become opportunities in a world that we can't predict in some ways? As the world gets more ecologically constrained, how will they perform? And that's, my grandfather was a banker. He often told us, don't save for the best time, save for the worst time. Because in good times, it's easy to earn money. It's really the cushion for when you fall. So when you invest, you want to invest in things that perform well when things don't go so well. Otherwise, we have the exact crisis as in the United States, where people tend to save for the best times, the biggest possible motorhome, and whatever possible. And then they're faced with losing their home at the same time as they lose their job. That's kind of the tragedy that we see in individual lives, but the same way through public investments. So even as a small step, we say, if we just took even basic economics a bit more seriously, what we should do is focus far more on wealth than on income. And really look at, are we depleting our wealth, which is the ability to generate income, or are we building it truly? It distinguishes between liquidation and true regeneration. When we make decisions, there are always two things we need to do at least. The first one we often forget. The first one is to understand the context. Because if you buy a ship, but there's no lake, it's not very useful. Same thing is true if you buy an asset that doesn't fit into the future, it's going to lose in value. That seems platitude, but we do as if that wasn't true. So we have that context. Once we understand the context, and that's why we do some scenarios and say, is this moderate hope of the United Nations something you can really depend on as being the context for our assets? I don't think so. Once you then develop a scenario that you feel comfortable with saying that's a physical possibility, then you can link it back to the next question. What are the choices within this context? Then you can choose which ones truly will perform well. And in net present value terms, it's very, look at Excel, but it's actually a little bit more sophisticated. You have to understand interest rates to say, is it likely that we have rapid expansion in a resource-constrained world? I don't think so. I don't think so. We can calculate with large discount rates. Small discount rates means the tail end of your investments become much more significant on your books. If you don't have clear thoughts about how it will perform in the future, it can ruin your entire balance. And it's also the counter-cyclical nature that I mentioned already. Are we investing in something that will perform well as a hedge against what you don't want to see happen? That's why I'm also involved with a group that we think of investors of thinking, how would you need to structure a portfolio that's actually outperforming gold? Because gold may be helpful, but that's not helpful enough. What kind of assets do we need to invest in far more and capitalize that allow us to do well in a resource-constrained world? What's that hedge? Because we do pay for fire insurance. Houses burn down about once every 10,000 years. If we think the risk of the Oxford student not arriving is more than 1 in 10,000, maybe useful to think of that hedge. With that, I would like to close, but also, again, to invite you to a number of things. One is, I brought some of these little booklets. You know that the Mark Twain story, that he wrote this long letter to his friend at the end. He said, if I had more time, I could have written it more shortly. So we tried to kind of do the short version to kind of just so you can read it in just 1 minute, but also if you have friends that are interested, please bring them to them, because it's a way to kind of help them get engaged in a conversation. Also, these little wallet cards, you can engage your fellow passenger on the bus or something, and get invited to dinners for interesting conversations. I also will circulate these yellow sheets for people interested in what we do. We have a newsletter that comes out every so often. If you're interested, put your email on, and then you hear from us from once in a while. And also, if you're interested more, if you have ideas on how to can pass a few around. how to engage with us. I left my breakfast open tomorrow for those interested in further in-depth conversations. Because the way what we want to see in the world, our ambition is very simple. We believe ultimately what we need to reach are 2,000 people. And these 2,000 people are key economic advisors to national governments behind the curtains. Not the ministers. The ministers, they have to speak to the public. They have great ideas. But if the great idea doesn't work for the advisors, they don't go anywhere. So these are the people who are in charge of making sure economies stay stable. As long as they don't see resource constraints as one of the top 5 or top 10 economic risks, nothing will move, in my opinion. I believe, and I think this evidence suggests, that already today, investing in assets that can work well in an ecologically constrained world is economical. Economic reality is already on the strong side of true sustainability. Not economic theory, not economic practice, but economic reality. I don't know if you get that distinction. So with that, I would like to summarize the following. What I see as the emerging principles for success. It's not very radical, but it's a slight shift. One is accounting. I believe it's important for a farmer to know how big their farm is. What a radical thought. Again, another platitude that I'm putting out. And we organize nations as if it did not matter whatsoever. I could talk about the UK, how they put more energy into the chewing gum. But we can have that discussion later. I believe biocapacity is the currency of the 21st century. I spoke with a central banker, one of the directors of the central bank in Colombia, who recognized that inflation is driven in Colombia by higher energy prices and higher food prices, none of which has anything to do with monetary policy. It's a physical phenomenon. And so he was quite aligned with the idea. And at the end, he told me, you're a global hector. It's the only currency backed up by reality. Which I thought was interesting. Not the fiat money. And so perhaps the most significant take-home lesson, apart from saying, very practically, we need to think about relative income. And suddenly starts to put everything upside down. The self-interest story is far more evident than we believe. It's not that we should go to the next climate convention and worry about having to make a commitment. It's really the opposite. If you're not ready for the future, you are not ready for the future. Not the platitude, but somehow forgotten. So with that, I would like to open the conversation with you about what can we do together, because I think, yes, we need to reach these 2,000 people. You don't reach them immediately and engage them, and engage them in a way that they say, yes, that's a risk. That's why we also work with the finance industry to help them see that risks, as S&P shows, they may not be the only one, that a resource-constrained world does have an influence on whether countries can or cannot pay back their debt. We work with international development agencies because there also the belief is that elephants and poverty are trade-offs that we have to choose. Or the right of to develop is impinged on by talking about planetary boundaries. That's the true conflict now for the sustainable development goals being discussed. While the reality is the exact opposite. Acknowledging resource constraints is the most pro-poor principle you can put on the table. Because for low-income people, they will not be able to access resources in a competition with high-income people. You know, that's kind of how the market works. So having access to resources is absolutely fundamental for low-income people, and that's work that we do also with other social entrepreneurs. And then also, obviously, more in the more classical environmental side, we're very proud of the collaboration, for example, with WWF, the only and first, so far, large conservation organization that recognizes that without moving out of overshoot, we cannot succeed with conservation. We do compete with other species, so there's some mathematical kind of balance point that we need to recognize. And I'm very proud of that collaboration and hope also that other conservation organizations and other organizations as a whole will start to engage at a conversation with a researcher, Catherine, from Oxfam. Kind of, there she is. On exactly these issues, and I think that's something, a conversation we need to have much more broadly, not just in some NGOs, but that's really kind of the essence, recognizing the resource reality on which we depend. And with that, I'm looking forward to your questions.